Just another day in the office. Well, welcome, church. We are in a series called Vocare, Work as Calling, and this is week three. In case you're joining us, and this is week one for you, I just want to give you a brief recap of the ground that we've covered so far. When we talk about work in this series, we don't just mean work that gets you a paycheck. Work is any effort you expend for the sake of others. I was thinking about how much work it takes to put on a service here on a Sunday, and you may not have any idea. You may think that it's the people on the stage, but it's so much broader than that. There are the people on the stage, of course, who are working very, very hard, particularly the worship band. But there's also the technical team at the back. There are the people who receive the offering, the people who serve you communion, the people who serve coffee, the greeters, the people who man the next steps. So on as the teachers of our children. Probably over 50 people are involved in serving on any given Sunday, and they are here very early in the morning, and it is work. It is work that they do with joy because they love the Lord and they want to serve you, but it's work. Other things which we might not automatically think of as work because there's no paycheck attached, but are very important, parenting. Some of you are stay-at-home mums and dads, and do I really need to ask if that is work? I think we know the answer. Many of you are retired, but you volunteer in various places. That is work. Students who go to school and study, it's all work. So this is relevant to all of us. Week one, we talked about the fact that work was intended to be good. God designed it, and there is a dignity to it. It existed before the fall of humankind. We like to think that sin entered the world, and then we had to work. But that's not the way it was. We had to work even before sin entered the world. But then there was the fall of humankind when we rebelled against God. God worked in creation and called us to work, tending the garden and creating culture. So we're all called to work, and we're called to work with excellence. Work can be a means of service and an act of love as we move beyond self-gratification to a greater cause. So that was sermons one and two. And some of you are thinking, why didn't you just say it that quickly the last couple of weeks? But I have to work. So on your outline, WWW, work went wrong. This is from the book of Genesis, and God is speaking to Adam and Eve after they have rebelled against him. To the woman, he said, I will make your pains in childbearing very severe until they invent epidurals. No, I'm just kidding. I will make your pains in childbearing very severe. With painful labor, you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. To Adam, he said, because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. So what we have here is paradise lost. It has become a broken, troubled world. The fall of Adam and Eve and the rest of the human race who have the same rebellious spiritual DNA, the fall into sin has been disastrous. It has unraveled the fabric of the entire world, and in no areas as profoundly as relationships and work. This world has become disordered by sin. Adam and Eve put themselves in God's place. They took upon themselves the right to decide how they should live and what was right and wrong for them to do. After this turning point, the human race began to live against the grain of the universe, against the grain of our own making and purpose. By the way, that's a woodworking analogy. I just thought some of you are thinking, what's grain, you know, meal got to do with this? But if you've ever done woodwork, and I was very, very bad at woodwork, or shop, as I think you call it in America. We call it woodworking in England because you're working with wood. But there would be a way that you would get... let me tell you how bad I was. Just a tiny... I was tasked with making a bookshelf in woodworking, and all I had to do was saw the end of the wooden plank square. You would think that wasn't very difficult. I can cut bread square, but I cannot apparently saw the end of a piece of wood square. So I had about 18 attempts to saw this square, and it was all different angles, and my shelf eventually became a letter rack. And that was what I ended up making. But Within the process of woodworking, you can do a plane with the grain and it goes smoothly, but if you go against the grain, everything splinters and falls apart. And that's what's happened with the human race. We are against the grain. The way in which we were designed to flow was in obedience to God, in loving relationship with Him and each other, and instead we're going against the grain of that and things splinter and things fall apart. Nothing works as it should. Sin leads to disintegration of every area of life. And emotionally, with Adam and Eve, and also for us, we see there's an internal shame and guilt and brokenness. There's a mistrust and fear of others. As soon as that sin happens, the blaming starts. Have you noticed that in the story? That God says to Eve, and she says it was the snake's fault. And then God says to Adam, and Adam says, this woman you put here with me, well, I listened to her, that was a mistake, this fruit-loving woman, and he starts blaming her, and so there's a relational breakdown starts happening immediately. So friction, anger, love, marriage, it all starts getting distorted, and two things in life become extremely hard, love and work. There's a parallel here in this passage between childbirth and work. Even when it bears fruit, it is painful, it often miscarries, and it sometimes kills us. So work becomes this environment of thorns and thistles. God made us for work, yet now we learn that work has become under the curse of sin. It becomes painful toil. Work is not itself a curse, but under all other aspects of human life, it is under the curse of sin. Thorns and thistles grow up as we try to grow food. And last week we saw that this gardening talked about in the book of Genesis is representative of all kinds of human labor and culture building. So this is a statement that all work and human effort will be marked by frustration and lack of fulfillment. So if ever you're having a bad day at the office or at home parenting or studying, this is not surprising. It is the way of the world after sin. And the point is that we will be able to envision far more than we can accomplish, both because of a lack of ability and resistance. Let me unpack those a little bit. Lack of ability. We just can't achieve what we want to achieve because we don't have the skill. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. You want to go after something, but you just don't have the skill. You feel out of your depth. For me, I know that parenting has been one of those. I was great on giving advice to other parents before I had children. You ever notice that? And then you realize that the advice you've been giving for years, unsolicited, because people just need to know, the advice you've been giving for years just doesn't work with your own child. You're like, now what do I do? Or it works with one, but it definitely doesn't work with the other. And I have never felt so helpless as I have in the experience of parenting. It's definitely an out-of-your-depth situation, or at least for me. For some of you, us, maybe we experience imposter syndrome. This is the idea that you have that you're in a position at work and you have this fear that one day they're going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing. And you live with this fear that I'm an imposter. They just haven't noticed yet, but the time is coming. Well, they'll notice. Or this sense that you've been promoted to the level of your incompetence. I don't know if you're familiar with that phrase, but basically you're promoted up to the point where people think you're competent. And then someone makes an assessment somewhere that if you go to the next level, you will be incompetent. It's too much for you. So you're promoted to the level of your incompetence. And that's not exactly encouraging, but that's lack of ability and it frustrates us. Or maybe there is resistance in the environment around us. The experience of work will include pain, conflict, envy, fatigue. Not all our goals will be met. And we can become bitterly disappointed with the results. So I'm going to look at a hypothetical example here from Tim Keller's book, Every Good Endeavor, just to see how this might play out in a work situation. Imagine that you're on a hospital administration team with a vision for making significant advances in patient care. So you make a series of important changes to how your medical staff sees and treats patients. And initial responses by patients are highly positive, and so are some key metrics on patient harm, such as blood infections, surgical site infections, and medication errors. But the various new accountability measures, such as department report cards and safety dashboards, have your medical staff up in arms. They complain that the pressure is too great, the measurements are unfair, and now an honest, inadvertent mistake can ruin a career. You try to reason with many of the staff, but you get defensive. in one staff meeting, you lose your cool and you say that many staff persons are failing to put the interests of the patients first. There may be some truth in your statement, but it backfires badly. And some key people decide to leave, and morale takes a sharp dip. What happened? Many things. You can look back and see places where you could have been more careful and sensitive to the fears of the staff. You maybe could not have taken the criticism so personally, so that you spoke unwisely in public meetings. So you and your sin were part of the problem. You, to put it starkly, were a thorn. The medical staff, in many cases, was simply being stubborn and concerned more about the possible blots on their personal record than about the safety of patients. Do you see how easily it can get there? A goal with which everyone would agree, better patient care, fewer problems, comes tumbling down because of your own sin and the sin of others. How typical of this is this of work? We have a goal, it seems straightforward, but somewhere along the way, sin, confusion, selfishness creep in, and it's a disaster. Something that should have been simple has now turned into a situation of thorns and thistles. It's hard. And so work becomes fruitless and pointless. Many workers are frustrated by having skills and abilities that are not properly utilized and aspirations that never get fulfilled. Many others experience no satisfaction or fulfillment in their work, even when they have realized their aspirations and become successful. Ecclesiastes 2:17 says this, "So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." So, for those of you that are not too familiar with the book of Ecclesiastes, most of the book is basically about how life looks when you don't bring God into the picture. And the conclusion that the writer draws is, it's pretty meaningless. The quest of the philosopher is to have a meaningful life based solely on what can be found within the confines of this material world, so achievement, pleasure, and learning. And he pushes the reader towards an understanding that you need God to be part of the picture. Nothing within this world is a sufficient basis for a meaningful life. And so in the book of Ecclesiastes, we see three life projects that he pursues to try and find meaning. And I think you'll see this in the world today. People are still pursuing these same three things. The first is a quest to make sense of life through learning and wisdom. And in the end, he says, counts for nothing. Number two, an effort to make life fulfilling through the pursuit of pleasure. And in the end, he says that basically your palate gets jaded and the pleasure is no more. And then three, the pursuit of achievement through hard work. And there's a long description of this, and I'm going to read it now. "So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. That yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I've poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days their work is grief and pain. Even at night their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God." So there's a hint of hope here. "For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." We were talking in the back room before the service started today, and Scott made the comment, and it's a very accurate one, that this really is a book that you should read all in one go. Because if you like read chapter 1 and then chapter 2 and chapter 3, you're like, oh no, it's so depressing. You really need the end where he says, but with God in the picture, and it livens up considerably. When we work, we want to make an impact. That can mean for some of us that we want personal recognition or to make a difference in our field or to do something to make the work, the world a better place. And the writer, the philosopher, argues that even if you are one of these few who accomplishes something, it's all for nothing. In the end, there are no lasting achievements. He didn't get invited to many parties. This guy is a bit of a downer. He says it's ultimately pointless if life under the sun is all there is. So it's a bit of a gloomy perspective, and it's designed to be so. Isn't life without God pointless, is the point he is making. What we find at the end, though, is a hint that though a person might find satisfaction in their toil, if it comes from the hand of God. And we'll come back to that later. But let's think more about how depressing work is. The alienation of work. Work can also alienate us from God and from one another. So it takes away our joy in the present. And a reason why work feels so alienating is due to the injustice and depersonalization, where you don't feel like a person, that's present in all social systems and which so often infects the work that we do. When we encounter bureaucracy, particularly from government agencies, this can be incredibly frustrating. It's almost a cliche that no one looks forward to a visit to the DMV. If you work at the DMV, I apologize for what I'm about to say, and I will repent personally to you afterwards. But even when you walk in, the fact that they ask you to take a number already hints at the depersonalization that can exist in such an environment. I'm a man, I'm not a number. But that's how we receive their work, but from their faces, they're not having much fun either. I was thinking this week about the Japanese car industry, and this industry where the concept of the assembly line was perfected, I think it was invented by Henry Ford, but perfected by the Japanese, they found that the assembly line process actually led to high levels of dissatisfaction amongst the employees. What they realized is that if a person just has a tiny role in the whole thing, if all their role is tighten this bolt, tighten this bolt, tighten this bolt, 20,000 times a day, there was very little satisfaction in that, because then the car would move down the line and they would never see the finished product. So one change they made a while ago was that instead of having one person just be responsible for one thing and never seeing the end result, they created teams of workers who together would build a car. And then that team would get to see the whole result. And that made a vast difference to the levels of satisfaction in the Japanese car industry. But transactions between humans have become less personal. In the old days, if you wanted a loan from the bank, you would go to your local bank, and if you lived in a small town, there's a fair chance that the bank manager or the loan officer would know you as a person. And they'll be able to factor into their decision what they know about you as a person. This is the type of banking that we see in It's a Wonderful Life. Remember that movie? And it's those relationships that George Bailey has established with his customers that eventually lead to them bailing him out. But in the modern finance industry, you can apply for a loan online, and the only thing that matters is the numbers. Your credit score, your income, your debt-to-income ratios, and so on. It has become depersonalized. In the drive for efficiency, we've lost something. And there is a cost to that on both sides of the transaction. In this modern technological world, we are often dealing with each other on the basis of data rather than personhood. Decisions are made according to algorithms rather than character. This is perhaps an unforeseen consequence of our lives becoming increasingly technological. This is probably heresy to say in Silicon Valley, by the way. Whoever's in charge of Silicon Valley will be calling me this week. There is a joke in the scientific community that in the future, the whole world will be run by a man, a machine, and a dog. What's the machine for? The machine runs the world. The man is there to feed the dog. What is the dog there for? The dog is there to make sure that the man doesn't touch the machine. And of course, the humor in this scenario is that you don't really need a man or a dog at all. The machine will take care of itself. Now, of course, technology can be used to remove some unpleasant and shameful human biases, such as loan decisions that were made on the basis of race or color. But there is definitely a downside. So let's summarize where we get to. Work was intended to be good, but as a result of sin, it became hard. There are thorns and thistles. Our work can be fruitless and pointless. Sin has affected every area, and so we are stifled by bureaucracy and made redundant and depersonalized by technology. In the light of this, is there any hope for work? Come back next week. No, I won't leave you there. Number three, the limits of work and a way forward. This is what the philosopher says in chapter 4. And I saw that all toil and all achievement spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. So laziness is not a good plan either. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. This is so profound. We're going to unpack this. Within the context of these verses, we see that part of the problem with work is that the motivation for it can be envy or competition with another person, which he concludes is meaningless and chasing after the wind, or as we have said earlier, fruitless and pointless. But within the last verse, there is some hope that it can be possible to have one handful with tranquility. What does this mean? It means that it's possible to have enough and you also experience equilibrium, that it is possible to have peace of mind amongst the presence of occasional fruitlessness and pointlessness. So how do we achieve satisfaction in the light of this? The philosopher says that any satisfaction that we can get in this world is always a miraculous gift of God. Yet we have a responsibility to pursue this gift through a particular balance. The balance is toil and tranquility. The balance is work, but having a peaceful heart in the midst of it. So how do we do this? Three things. Firstly, we need to recognize our tendency to make idols of money and power. As I talked about last week, that will skew how we view work and how we view relationships if we have idols of money and power in our life. Secondly, we put relationships in their proper place. Work can convince you that you are working hard for your family and friends while you are being seduced through ambition to neglect them. How many times have we seen the scenario where a wife or a husband or children would say, you know what, I'd rather have a little bit less money and a bit more husband or a bit more wife, a bit more daddy, a bit more mummy. This has to be kept in balance. And third, we recognize the limits of work, what it can and what it can't do, what it should do and what it was never designed to do. We talked last week about how easy it is to get our identity wrapped up in our work, which is why so many of us suffer an amazing loss of confidence and understanding of ourselves if ever we are out of work. We don't know who we are anymore. And some people experience this when they retire. They just don't know what to do with themselves. They don't know who they are. But work was never designed to answer the ultimate questions about our worth and value. Work was never designed to give the final answer to our significance. That is found somewhere else. That is found through someone else. The last thing I want to talk about this morning is the work of Jesus. It's here we turn to Jesus' work on the cross. The deep questions that we all have in our soul. Am I worth something? Am I making a contribution that counts? Am I valuable? Does anyone care about me and what I do? These are all answered through work, but not through our work, through the work of Jesus on the cross. On the cross, we see exactly what we are worth. We see exactly how precious and valuable we are to God. We see exactly how much he cares. Jesus' work on the cross means that our work does not need to answer those questions. It has already been answered. When Jesus cried out, Tetelestai, on the cross, it is finished. He means the work has been done. It is complete. All that was necessary to put us right with God has been accomplished on the cross. The truest thing about us, that we are loved by God, is evidenced by the sacrifice of his Son. The ultimate source of our satisfaction, the ultimate source of our tranquility, the ultimate source of our peace, is Jesus. Work cannot save us. Work cannot tell us our true value, whatever our paycheck might say. But Jesus can. We're going to transition to a time of communion where we remember Jesus' work on the cross and just what that means for us. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him and with him two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read this sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, "Do not write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be King of the Jews." Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, dividing them into four shares, one for each of them, with the undergarment remaining. This garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. "Let's not tear it," they said to one another. "Let's decide by lot who will get it." This happened that the scripture might be fulfilled that said, "They divided my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment." So this is what the soldiers did. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to her, "Woman, here is your son." And to the disciple, "Here is your mother." From that time on, this disciple took her into his home. Later, knowing that everything had now been finished, and so that scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I am thirsty." A jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it, put the sponge on a stalk of the hyssop plant, and lifted it to Jesus' lips. When he had received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." With that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. He died that we might live. His work brings us rest and peace. Let us remember him now. Let us pray. Jesus, we thank you for your work on the cross. And that was not easy work. In the Garden of Gethsemane, you cried out to your Father, "If there is any other way." But there was no other way. There is no remission of sins without the shedding of blood. And you are willing to give your own. So Jesus, as we eat this bread and drink this cup, we are reminded of the sacrifice that you made for us, the work that you did on the cross to answer the questions that our work cannot answer, of what we are worth, of what our value truly is. And we thank you that in you we find peace, we find tranquility. Thank you.